This is the time set for oral arguments for the en banc court. The first case today is Golden Road Motor Inn versus MEI GSR Holdings LLC et al. Case number 64349. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Dodson, are you arguing for appellant cross respondent?
May I begin?
Yes.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Dodson. Along with Robert Eisenberg, I represent Atlantis in these consolidated appeals. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal and arguments on the cross appeals. The Atlantis took extraordinary measures to protect its intellectual property. It spent years to develop proprietary analysis of high-value gaming guests, tracking their play, and developing marketing offers that would best cultivate their play and increase the value of those guests. That intellectual property, however, and those efforts to maintain that intellectual property were circumvented by a low-tech means, by a highly trusted executive casino host who took little spiral notebooks, and this is an example of it, went into her office and copied from her computer screen the proprietary trade secret information about known gaming guests of the Atlantis, guests that were hosted by her and guests that were hosted by other persons at the Atlantis.
Counsel, this included more than just her book.
This included more than her book. It included more than what she had brought with her from when she arrived at the Atlantis 6 years earlier. It included items that were specifically found by the district court below to be trade secret items, including, most easily, other hosts' guests and information about other hosts' guests. It included recent loss. It included credit information. It included their rating and tier information. It included everything you needed to know that that person was a highly valuable gaming guest and what you should do to try to move that person's play from one property to another. Justice Douglas, did you have a question?
No, you've pretty much answered some of my question, but I guess coming full circle back to it, I appreciate that in distinguishing what you would consider proprietary in nature. But could you speak to the non-compete?
Yes, I'd love to. Because these two things, this appeal at its heart raises two Nevada statutes that are very important to the public policy and the business-friendly nature of this state, the Uniform Trade Secret Act and NRS 613-200, which is the Nevada's employment statute that allows non-competes. And had either of those obligations, those statutory obligations, been observed in this case, much of the damages would not have occurred. The non-compete agreement in this case was entered between Islam and the Atlantis. And it was a good agreement based upon the law of this state as well as the cases that have been set forth by this court. It had restrictions that were appropriate geographically at 150 miles, and that was so found by the district court below. It had a restriction term of 1 year, which is well within the confines that have been approved by this court in the past, and it was approved by the district court below.
What about the restriction on providing any services within that 1 year period of time within 150 miles? Isn't that pretty restrictive?
Your Honor, that is what almost all restrictive covenants that this court has considered and that exist do. And it is actually, if you look at NRS 613-200, and I would encourage the court to do that, that says specifically, and I want to actually read it, allows for an agreement that prohibits post-employment competition and it says, in a similar vocation or becoming employed by a competitor of the person, association, or company.
Counsel, isn't that slightly different, though? You're looking at a casino host or hostess to be opposed to someone who's merely serving drinks, waiting tables, working at an information station. Doesn't that differ from the purpose of a non-compete?
Well, the purpose of the non-compete, as stated in the statute and in this court's case law, is to protect the business interests of the employer. And regardless of what the position of employment is, unless they're simply being paid to stay at home, they can share information with their new employer. And if they do, and the only way to be certain that they don't is to have
them employed. That, where you're going right now begs the issue. The issue is she was a casino host. And the non-compete was, at least from my limited means, overreaching in terms of there was no job in a casino that she could hold, period. Not
correct.
The limited area executive or as a hostess.
Well, first of all, in this case, she took the exact same position. But even so, in order to protect the business interests, even if she took a job as a dishwasher, if she shared the same information she shared in this instance, she would have violated that business interest that that same statute in the next sentence says is allowed to be protected.
So as a practical matter, even if the non-compete agreement were rewritten because it was perceived to be overbroad because she could go to work as a dishwasher, she didn't go to work as a dishwasher. She went to work as a casino host. And that was clearly barred by the agreement.
Exactly. And it was barred by any good faith application of that agreement because the exact same title, albeit for more compensation. And the information that was shared, in that next sentence of 613.200, it says, or disclosing any trade secrets, business methods, or lists of customers, which would seem to imply that in this state, our legislature has made a determination it's appropriate to use non-compete agreements to protect not just trade secrets, but customer lists specifically, even if they weren't trade secrets. And in this instance, she took 256 pages of these, actually probably more because there was a sixth binder that was lost at the GSR. And from information she had copied from the screen and inputted and admitted over 220 to be precise, names, contact information to the GSR database. And then she also shared and applied her knowledge, not just the information on the sheets, but her specific knowledge from 6 years of employment of the trade secrets of the Atlantis as to what sort of solicitations, what sort of marketing offers should be made to those known guests.
Counsel, I hear you, but part of it, I'm having some problems because we are in a right-to-work state. And so the public policy is to allow people to work freely. It does allow some limitations. She's just out of the gaming business totally for that period of time. And I guess I would like to hear a distinction in terms of when you talk about book of business, your distinction in terms of what she brought with her book of business, so to speak, or what generally is contained and is not a trade secret, or is what you consider a trade secret.
Well, the district court found that the information that makes up a host's book of trade or book of business is information that she obtained outside of any contractual prohibition to develop that trade secret or that technique. In other words, things she knows outside of her work. If she learns something even, it's not her guess, but she sees somebody playing craps and she learns that while she's at the Atlantis, then that's a trade secret. If she learns that somebody likes steaks because she meets somebody at a steak restaurant downtown, that's not a trade secret. It's outside of her employment. Just as an engineer or a code writer at Google, the work that they perform and what they learn, they can't move. If it is their contractual obligation, and if pursuant to the Uniform Trade Secret Act, that information is protected by that employer such that it is a trade secret. In other words, in this instance, it was impossible to copy this information or obtain this information. There were four contracts in place to protect the information, and the Atlantis went to extraordinary measures to do so. Not all, and there was testimony at trial, that not all properties do that. Not all properties did that in the past. But as with all industries, the gaming industry, which is so critical to this state, is evolving. And now I would submit to you it is impossible, given these four contracts, for a host to develop a book of trade while they are within and on the property of the Atlantis.
Could you clarify the issue about what is considered to be proprietary information for me? if a casino host has a list of clients, their addresses, and their contact information, my impression from the record and from the statements made in the briefs is that the parties seem to believe that that's something that goes with the casino host as they travel between and among casinos. Is that correct?
It is not correct, and I'll say why.
Okay.
It is if that list is brought from one property, and it is actually a trade secret at best of that casino host. Again, let's say that host developed, say at trial there was a host that testified who worked at the Riverboat Casino that used to exist in Reno. They had no confidentiality agreements. There was no restriction on development of a book of trade, and she testified as such. So she developed a book of trade there, and she left there and went to the Atlantis. There was no restriction on her use of that. But at the Atlantis, there are contracts that prohibit her from taking the information that the Atlantis has developed.
But are you suggesting, and I didn't read your brief to say this, are you suggesting that a casino host who has a list of clients or customers and goes to work for the Atlantis and signs the agreements that the Atlantis had her sign is precluded from taking the same people with her to the Grand Sierra?
Absolutely not. Those 18 people, she can bring their contact information, their names and their contact information. What she can't bring, and what will be a trade secret based upon the evidence adduced at this trial, is the marketing strategies.
So the evidence developed was that she had some 18 folks when she came to the Atlantis, and when she went to Grand Sierra, she took many more other customers' names and contact information. But then in any event, she also supplied to Grand Sierra gaming preference information about those individuals. Is that right?
That is partially right, except I need to correct the beginning of your statement. She actually had and presented to the Atlantis when she came to work a list of over 1,000 guests. That's Exhibit 75 at trial.
Okay. Right.
Of those, only 18 are amongst the 220 that the GSR admitted were added to its database by her. And then when she arrived at the Grand Sierra Resort, she used not only information about those 220 guests, but other persons who were already in the database, updating basically the understanding of the Grand Sierra Resort as to the value of those players and what sort of marketing efforts towards those players they would be receptive to. And then she employed that knowledge, and there's undisputed evidence in the emails and in the multiple methods where that information was employed and used by the Grand Sierra Resort to then solicit those persons to move their business, and in fact, they admitted they moved their business to the Grand Sierra Resort. I mean, amazingly, the damages awarded against Ms. Islam are the damages, the net profit, that the Grand Sierra Resort admitted earning from the people that were added to its database by Ms. Islam. That's what the district court employed, but yet it found no use of that information by the Grand Sierra Resort.
Would you like to speak to that?
It is stunning to me that the district court's order puts in a permanent injunction against Ms. Islam that she cannot use the information that she brought to the Grand Sierra Resort.
Was there any showing that the Grand Sierra Resort had knowledge?
At some point in time, Your Honor, they have to have knowledge because there are not only emails before they received.
Did Atlantis provide them with a list of customers that were prohibited from her passing that information on? Did they do anything of that sort?
Absolutely not, because that would be providing, they would then be making public the very trade secret they're attempting to protect. But Ms. Islam can't, although Ms. Islam can't use that information at the Grand Sierra Resort, there is no permanent injunction, and that same information that she provided is likely still being utilized today.
My understanding of the record was in her interview for that new position, she was told specifically not to bring her book of business or anything else to that.
That was the testimony that was provided.
And so to hold this new employer liable, don't we have to have some kind of showing to create this nexus about use of information?
Pursuant to the statute, and I have to be brief here because I only have a minute, all that they have to do is demonstrate that all we have to do is demonstrate that it has been used with knowledge that it came from a person who was under an obligation to keep it protected. And at least when I filed this lawsuit and when TROs were put in place and a preliminary injunction was put in place, that use should have stopped.
That goes as to Ms. Islam, but there's no relationship between Atlantis and Gran Sierra.
There doesn't have to be a relationship under the Uniform Trade Secret
Act. And with no knowledge.
There has to be knowledge, which once a lawsuit was filed and once the cease and desist letter was applied, certainly there was knowledge.
But how would they know what to cease and desist from if you never provided them with who those people were that they were supposed to stay away from?
Because they know that she is uploading information onto their database and providing them with marketing offers based upon their play at the Atlantis.
Which would
they say that in the emails?
Which would include gaming preference information?
Which would include value tiers, gaming preference information, so much so as even to describe, you know, the types of meals and drinks.
Which apparently everybody in the case acknowledges is proprietary.
The marketing information, absolutely, Your Honor. And that's each property uses algorithms. And the evidence here was that because of the information that was being provided by Ms. Islam, GSR modified what would otherwise be its offers, its mass marketing offers, to guests, and actually offered over $1 million, or approximately $1 million of free play, that otherwise wouldn't have been offered.
Because they knew what to expect, is your contention.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
That because they knew what to anticipate in terms of the performance of that customer.
Yes, and that information was specifically provided by Ms. Islam, directing, basically guiding the marketing efforts to move play from Atlantis known guests to the GSR. And that's a violation because it is a use of information that they know is coming from the Atlantis, because she just spent 6 years working from the Atlantis. There's nowhere else she could have obtained that information.
Okay, Mr. Dodson, we've asked you some questions. You'll have 3 minutes for rebuttal. And the other side will have a collective total of 18 minutes. I'm not sure how you're dividing your time or if you're dividing your time.
Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Johnson.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Stan Johnson, and I, along with Steve Cohen, represent the Gran Sierra Resorts in this appeal. The district court consistently and correctly found that upon substantial evidence, the GSR had not violated the Nevada Trade Secret Act. The court also found that the non-compete agreement was overbroad and unenforceable as a matter of law, and then also that the other claims brought by the Atlantis against the GSR were without merit. The district court further awarded GSR or Gran Sierra Resorts its attorney's fees pursuant to a valid and rejected offer of judgment. But we also have appealed one issue, which is the award of additional attorney's fees, which we believe should have been awarded pursuant to the trade secret statute. The trade secret issue, I think, is an interesting
profits one. Awarded to Mrs. Were the profits awarded to Atlantis that against Ms. Islam? Profits earned after the cease and desist letter.
Yes, there was an award of damages against Ms. Islam, which was based on net profits.
And those were net profits earned after the cease and desist letter.
That's correct.
Okay. Why didn't the cease and desist letter place Gran Sierra on notice that it was abridging, as the cease and desist letter argued, a valid, enforceable covenant not to compete?
Well, the letter from Atlantis, dated April 6, 2012, which was addressed to Ms. Islam, and then there was also a letter to Mr. Flaherty. But in the April 6 letter, the Atlantis says, "It appears that you are making marketing offers to guests who have never been in your book of trade." And so that was the issue that the Atlantis actually raised with the GSR and with Ms. Islam, was that there were offers being made outside of her book of business. So it wasn't an issue that she couldn't take her book of business with her, but the issue really was what was in the book of business. And as the court found, there was consistent testimony from everyone involved in the case, those that testified on behalf of the Atlantis, those that testified on behalf of Grand Sierra Resorts, that consistently in the industry, hosts, executive hosts, were allowed to take with them their book of business.
But that testimony did not include gaming preferences and other preferences of the customer in the casinos from which they came, did it?
That's correct. The court found...
Didn't the material that you downloaded, your company download, include those gaming preferences that you obtained from Ms. Islam?
No, it did not. What the court found was that there was no evidence that the Grand Sierra Resorts had received that additional information. The information that the Grand Sierra Resorts received was the name and contact information of the player. The court found that the database in which Simone had entered this information was restricted to allow for the entry of the name and the contact information. There was not a method for her to enter this additional information.
But that data also included information concerning players that were beyond her book of business when she came over to GSR.
That was the allegation, Your Honor, but there is no evidence that the Grand Sierra Resorts knew that.
Well, weren't you on notice from the cease and desist letter that this may be occurring?
What we were on notice was that there was a dispute over what was in her book of business.
So you decided to proceed regardless of the notice.
Well, what we did is we wrote a letter back to the Atlantis, and we specifically asked, this is our letter dated April 18, 2012, and we indicated that we had done due diligence. We had talked with Simona. We had talked with her and said, do you have any information that belongs to the Atlantis, or do you just have information that's in your book of business? She indicated to us that the information was only the information that she had in her book of business. These were players that she had a relationship with and therefore would be properly in her book of business. That's what she indicated to us. That's also what the court found. There were additional confirmations of that. Later, she again indicated, even at the time she was suspended, she was asked again, do you have any information that belongs to the Atlantis other than your book of business? She said no. Again, that's one of the findings of the court. But what we also did when we responded to the Atlantis, we said, based on the foregoing, I demand that you immediately come forward with any information that Ms. Islam either sabotaged your database or that Ms. Islam or GSR are in possession of proprietary information that is eligible to be protected as a trade secret. So we specifically asked and said, if you're saying that she is soliciting people that are not in her book of business, let us know who they are, and we'll determine whether that's true or not. We received no information. They ignored that and instead filed the litigation. In regards to the...
In your communications or invitations to the customers that were provided to you by Ms. Islam, you did not include proposals for that were based on their gaming preferences? Is that what you're representing?
We did not base any proposals on anything that we didn't think was just normal information in her book of business.
That's not my question. Did the proposals you submitted to their customers include gaming preference information obtained from Ms. Islam?
We believe no, Your Honor, because what the offers were about were just free play offers. They weren't specific to saying, well, you like to play this or you like to play that, or we know you're a certain tier level or that type of thing. These were just the normal mailings that went out in the course of mass mail marketing that all casinos engage in that dealt with offers for free play. And the testimony by Ms. Hadley was that there was nothing unusual about these offers. She testified, and she's been in the industry for 30 years, but what she testified to is all hosts want to make large offers to their players. So if a host comes in and says, I'd like to make, you know, these offers to these people, that's just considered at a level that does not involve what that's based on. It doesn't involve, well, we think that's some sort of trade secret information or something of that nature. It's just a matter of, does that offer make sense? And that's all that we did, is we looked at the type of offer that she wanted to make, and based on what other hosts did, what everyone else did, there was nothing unusual about that information. And that gets back to...
But you would not have made those offers but for her presentation to you of the customers that she thought you should address them to, and in what amount, correct?
Well, all she did was say, I'd like to make these offers to these people.
And so the answer to my question is yes.
Well, there was no indication that it was based on information that would have been protected. When hosts come on board, they all want to make offers to those people to try to get them into the casinos. That's their job. So there was nothing unusual, nothing that would have put us on notice that she was using proprietary information or something of that nature.
That and seems a little, I'm not trying to be critical, but you must have assumed that she based these on something.
Well, any host book of business is based on relationships. And those relationships are developed over years. Casino hosts know what their players do. They know how they play. They know the amounts they play in general. They know that information.
So what I'm understanding is that your due diligence to proceed with sending out invitations to these customers consisted of re-interviewing Ms. Islam.
A number of times. We asked her, we emailed her, we made a number of
verifications. Regardless of the number of times, your due diligence consisted of re-interviewing Ms. Islam and getting, again, her assurances that what she was giving you wasn't protected by the agreements.
That's correct. But we also asked the Atlantis for the information. If they would provide it, we could have done more, but they didn't. Now, Mr. DiCarlo, who was the executive in charge of the casino hosts at the Atlantis, testified that in the same situation, the Atlantis has to rely on what the hosts tell them. That was his testimony. He says, when we bring in a host, just like they brought Simone in from Harrah's, when we bring in a host, we have to rely on what they tell us. If they say, this is my book of business, we rely on that, and that's what they
did. But they brought her in as a concierge, did they not?
They did.
From Harrah's.
There was some dispute over really what her function was, but they called it that. And that was because that restrictive covenant was limited only to serving as a host. And so that's why they did that. But the evidence and the testimony indicated that they actually brought in her actual printout from the Harrah's and entered that into their database even prior to her serving the 6 months in the concierge's office.
Mr. Johnson, could you address another issue? Counsel argued in his opening that this set of facts would otherwise or is governed by 613-200. Could you argue or offer an explanation as to why that's not so?
Well, as far as the covenant not to compete?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The covenant not to compete is governed by Nevada statutory law, and that 613-200 would extend to the facts in this circumstance.
Correct.
Why is that not so?
Well, the court found that the restrictive covenant was overbroad as a matter of law, and I think it's very clear that it was. Including the testimony of Ms. Robinson, who was general counsel for the Atlantis, testified that under the restrictive covenant, someone could not park cars.
Wouldn't that be applicable if you'd have hired Ms. Islam to park cars or be a dishwasher? How is it applicable? How can you find an overbreadth when she goes to work in the exact same capacity? covered by the agreement. I mean, I'm having difficulty understanding how the court could rewrite the agreement on an overbreadth argument when she doesn't go to work for the other gaming opportunities. She goes to work for the exact same position. So it's not overbreadth as to that, is it?
Well, if it had been properly drafted, no. But what the court found was that it was improperly restrictive as a matter of law, which meant that it was defective, it was unenforceable from the beginning because of the fact that it was drafted so broadly. As the court pointed out, it wasn't just that she couldn't work as a casino host or that she couldn't even work at the casino. The testimony was under that protective covenant, they couldn't have worked at a 7-Eleven because there was gaming there. They couldn't have worked at a grocery store that had gaming. They couldn't have worked at the airport because there's gaming there. And not only just working, but it was so broad that it said any services, providing any services to a casino or a gaming establishment. That would also cover you couldn't deliver linen.
Let me ask you a question. I hate to interrupt you. I just had a question while I, as a follow-up to Justice Hardesty. You had an opportunity to review the covenant not to compete or the non-competition agreement. And is the basis that you decided to hire her just as what you say, you made the determination yourselves that it was overbroad and unenforceable.
Yes, that's one of the things the court found, that there was...
No, I'm talking about what you found when you were making the determination whether or not to hire her after having an opportunity to review that agreement.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And the court did find that, and that was part of the findings, that there was advice of counsel as to the Grand Sierra Resorts in regards... Simona under her non-compete agreement. That was one of the issues that was raised during the trial and one of the findings the court made regarding the non-compete. But as far as the breadth of it, clearly it was overbroad. And the court, it's not ambiguous. The contract is not ambiguous. It's clear on its face. It is what it was meant to do. It was meant to be that restrictive. And so the court found, as a matter of law, that it was unenforceable because of the way it was drafted. So I think, that's the basis of the court's finding on that issue, which is why the Grand Sierra Resorts was not found to be liable for breaching the non-compete agreement.
And it's your contention that blue penciling the agreement to narrow it is only appropriate in the injunctive relief setting?
That's correct. The cases cited by the appellant are all cases that dealt with modifications of an injunction in regards to a restrictive covenant. There was no case law that we could locate in Nevada that dealt with that issue, whether a court could actually rewrite the agreement. In fact, the law...
Or say that that's a hypothetical dispute, and in this case, casino hostess to casino hostess is the same thing, and the contract legitimately applies.
Well, again, but the analysis is at the beginning where there's a determination whether there was a...
Whether it's invalid as a matter of law because contrary to public policy. Your position is that.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
Got it. I have a question for you, and we're occupying all of your co-counsel's time here. You make the argument that your client should have received fees under 600A 090 or 060?
Yes.
Because they only got post-offer judgment fees, and that would have entitled them to fees from the get-go.
Correct.
I have a question. That statute seems to me not to apply to, it applies to claims for misappropriation made in bad faith, and there's no finding that the initial claims, even crediting the district court's ultimate finding that it shouldn't have been maintained against your client. But there's no finding that the claim out of the chute was made in bad faith against your client. And so my question to you is, how do you get a statutory basis for attorney's fees out of the text of 600A-060? It's a Uniform Act provision. What do the cases elsewhere say on that?
Well, what we're really looking at is some of the findings of the court. For example, in the appendix 1402, in the findings, the court indicated that there was subjective bad faith shown by the plaintiffs in their knowledge, and in the end, there was no evidence that justified bringing the action and maintaining the action. That's what.
Well, they said maintaining the action, but there was an injunction entered to which your client stipulated, and so did Ms. Islam. So I'm hard-pressed to find that the action was brought in bad faith absent a specific finding to that effect by the district court, and I don't see it. You're saying it's on page 1402?
Yes.
Okay.
The court even said, and this entitles GSR to attorney's fees and costs in this matter, and he was referring to a California case that directly addressed those issues.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Johnson? All right, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Did you have argument, Mr. Ray?
Your Honor, I don't know where the clock is. I don't know.
The time was consumed, but I'll give you 3 minutes. I'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Mark Ray. I represent Simona Islam. All of the findings that we've been talking about were made against my client, as you know. I had originally filed an appeal on her behalf of some of the findings on the breach of contract and trade secrets. I did not pursue that. Why? Because on a case-by-case basis, Judge Feininger was able and allowed to make his own findings of fact and conclusions of the law in a three-week trial. Some of those findings are now being discussed here. But I felt that the findings that had been made were based on the evidence, substantial evidence, in good faith. I could not appeal against adverse findings made after by a judge in a three-week trial. I point that out to you because of the discussion we've already had here. But the real issue that I brought on appeal was that of all of the discussion that's happened about Ms. Islam, the one thing that concerned me the most, and I hope it concerns you, is that in the 6,052 pages of the record in this case, there is no billing records of the firm that obtained the attorney's fees award against my client for $308,000. My client had a judgment against her for $43,000, including $20,000 in punitive. However, that award is dwarfed by the $308,000 in attorney's fees for which I received no paperwork. I received simply an affidavit of counsel stating that the total sum of hours on a monthly basis was this much money, and therefore we owed this much money. Apparently, in camera, Judge Flanagan saw some additional records. I did not. In raising this appeal, I thought that this would be an opportunity for this court under 54D2B to make clear that when we apply for attorney's fees, sometimes the attorney's fees are far more significant to a party like my client in the sums that they are awarded than any amount of damages. And this case is a perfect example. And I hope that this court will make it clear that if you want to apply for attorney's fees under 54D2B, it is your obligation to serve the other counsel with all the evidence upon which you base your request for fees.
Really, my only observation is it seems inconsistent to me that the trial judge would hold against your client on a contract it found to be unenforceable as a matter of law as to GSR, but nevertheless find liability against your client on the same contract.
The contract that was found liability on was several contracts, Your Honor. I think Mr. Dotson can inform you there were many contracts signed by my client, one of which was the non-compete. But I would say this, in case you all didn't know it, the non-compete was enforced against my client completely. It was enforced.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, I just wanted you to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I was. Thank you. Mr. Dotson, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address some of the questions that were brought.
Go ahead. Just go ahead with what you want.
The question was, what was the net profit that the GSR had admitted to earning? And if you look at the record, at 4622. You're going to see some charts like this. I need my reading glasses to read the small ones. But it's divided up by the GSR before and after the temporary restraining order. And you will see that it admitted to $86,892,000 of net profit. And by the way, that's after you take away these incredibly rich offers of free play that it earned from players coded to Ms. Islam. That is their own admission of use, in addition, by the way, to the request for admission, which were also admitted at trial. With regard to due diligence after they received the cease and desist letter, this email, which we didn't appreciate until trial, it's from Simona Islam on April 12th to SBC 8310. We figured out during the course of trial that is counsel Steve Cohen at counsel table. It says, here are the documents you requested. I'm sending you my list of players and also highlighting all new accounts I entered. Most of these people received letters from me. Furthermore, I attached a sample letter of what they received. If you have any questions, please let me know. It doesn't say these people are in her book of trade. It doesn't even seem to be responding to that question. It attaches a list of approximately 350 people and a sample letter where they were receiving $100 to $500 in free play. These were solicitations made by the GSR from and at the direction of Simona Islam that were, and the evidence of which ones were cashed, were also at trial.
What's the record site?
That site is 5320 for the email, and of course the other documents follow. With regard to the non-compete, if this court requires that it be so specifically tailored as to be a particular type of job or position, I would suggest it will be very good for my business, but very bad public policy for this state, because it will be inviting circumvention. That is why most non-competes have a blanket, and why our statute, I believe, has a blanket restriction against being employed by a competitor.
There is an issue, though, that has been raised appropriately, that where the court has previously rewritten covenants not to compete, it's been in the injunctive context. Should this court revisit or expand or clarify Jones when discussing summary judgment or verdict judgments and in instances in which the covenant not to compete encompasses the exact area, reject the overbreadth argument?
I think it would be, there are so many very strong public policy issues that are raised by this case. It's a great opportunity for this court. And I think this is an opportunity to express exactly what's going to be the public policy in the state for drafting and, if necessary, by giving courts, including district courts, not this court, the opportunity to blue pencil a restrictive covenant so as to make it fit a particular circumstance. And I would encourage and I wish you would take that opportunity to make it clear for all of the practitioners and the judges as to how they should address restrictive covenants, because they are becoming more and more common, and there's an important part of the business-friendly atmosphere we're attempting to create in this state, as well as the Uniform Trade Secret Act and how they blend.
Any additional questions?
One question. Issue was raised as to the appropriateness of attorney's fees as a Ms. Islam in light of notice and opportunity.
I disagree with the representation of my colleague, though I have great respect for him. That the original submission had everything that was required by Rule 54. It had my affidavit. It had everything you needed for a Lodestar. It did have the bills. What it didn't have was the two-tenths of, we do our invoices to the tenth of an hour. Bruce Laxall taught me to make it such that if you read the bill, you don't need a status letter, because you know everything that has happened and everything that you've talked about with the client is on those telephone communications. I mean, that's what it is, a brief summary of it. So that was submitted in camera. Now, eventually, the district court ordered...
It was submitted in camera to the court.
It was. After the court's request.
Was it provided to counsel or...
It was not until the district court directed us to redact it and provide it to counsel, which we did. And there was
As no, you argued that it was attorney-client privilege.
Exactly.
And the court, or it's indicated that the court analyzed Beatty and Brunzell factors as well.
The court did, both Brinzell and Beatty, for our award of attorney's fees.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
It's worrisome, though. If your summaries and your attorney fee bill were sufficient to inform your opponent what they comprised and the district court could do its analysis, it seems to me that submitting the bills themselves in camera adds a wrinkle that's unfair to the person on the other side. I mean, you live by the sword, you die by it. It seems to me if you're going to do the super detailed status letter substitute, and I'll credit you, that does get to the level of attorney's fees and costs, but then you can't use those to submit to the court as a secret discussion of your case and your thinking and everything else in assessing the award and hide that from the person on the other side. That worries me.
It quite candidly, I always try to be candid with this court and every court, I'll never do it again in that fashion. I had seen it done. I had done it.
Because you can do a summary. I mean, you
can do a summary. And that's what was originally submitted. And the motion said at the end, if an in-camera review would be helpful, we'd be happy to provide it. And we shouldn't have put that in there, is the bottom line. But eventually, whatever injury was caused was cured because the redacted bills were then provided.
Redacted for attorney-client privilege.
For attorney-client privilege, yes.
But had been submitted to the court.
But they had already been submitted unredacted to the court. That is true, Your Honor.
Which is arguably a waiver.
No. All of the case law, in fact, every case that is cited by my opponent, the cure on remand was to provide redacted copies.
Okay.
And I would encourage you to look at our brief and the discussion of that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dodson. The case will stand submitted. I'd like to thank